Hey, super friends, if you're a fan of the Geek History Lesson podcast, then you might be a fan of our next comic book called Jupiter Jet and the Forgotten Radio, the second graphic novel in the Jupiter Jet series. It is hitting comic book shops on October 7th and bookstores on October 20th of this year. If you don't know about Jupiter Jet, of course, is the story of a 17-year-old girl with a jetpack who desperately dreams of soaring through the solar system. But when the mysterious black flyer shows up to her world, Jupiter Jet soon will find out that being a superhero requires more than just a jetpack. It features a John Boy Myers of Spawn and Teen Titans cover, and of course, it is 120 pages of adventure science fiction. If you like comic books like Superman Smashes the Clan, DC Superhero Girls, or IDW's Canto, then you're going to love Jupiter Jet and the Forgotten Radio. And don't just take our word for it. Ron Mars, creator of Kyle Rayner Green Lantern, had this to say. I know a little something about building heroes, and this is how you do it, with heart and humor and high adventure. And we're very thankful that Ron Mars gave us a quote for Jupiter Jet and the Forgotten Radio. So, how does this work? Jupiter Jet and the Forgotten Radio can be found on Amazon, can be found on Walmart.com, can be found on any independent bookstore's online website, or you can walk into your local comic book shop and pre-order the book today. If you know anything about the independent author market, then you know that pre-orders really matter. So we would ask that you go into your comic book store today and pre-order Jupiter Jet and the Forgotten Radio. It's our love letter to the comic books of the past, of the 90s, and it's perfect for your grandmother, your dog, and your three-year-old daughter or son. Go check out our next comic book, Jupiter Jet and the Forgotten Radio, hitting comic book stores October 7th. And now, on to the show.
Everyone was excited about this, so we are here to do it. We are discussing your top five queer comic book characters because your geek history lesson is now in session. Hello and welcome to Geek History Lesson. I'm Ashley Victoria Robinson.
And I am Jason. What a great costume, Inman. Welcome to your Mind University. We say that this is the Mind University because this is the podcast where you come to learn about characters and teams and constructs. And some of our favorite episodes are lists. And I'm very excited for this one because we're talking about the top five queer comic book characters. And this is a heavily requested episode on our GHL Patreon and GHL Twitter and GHL Facebook.
This is also, this is a lesson we've tried to do for literal years at this point and has usually suffered to production woes, but this is a tough year, so we thought that we would go ahead and we would do this right now, not in Pride Month, because it's great to be queer all year long.
Yes, and we have an amazing guest, Ashley, scoured the ends of the internet to bring what I think is a perfect guest for this podcast. Ashley, why don't you introduce our amazing guest and introduct.
We are joined today by the amazing, the very kind, the new internet friend, Sarah Century, the co-host of Bitches on Comics, writer for Sci-Fi Wire, Fangirls, Bitch Media, Autostraddle, The Establishment, and so many more incredible publications. Sarah, welcome to Geek History Lesson, and thank you for joining us.
Yes, I am so excited to be here. What a great episode to be on.
Now, Sarah, I would love, we love to talk to our guests a little bit before we dive into the list. And just, do you remember, like, what were some of your things that got you into comic books or got you into genre? What were some of your favorite comic books when you were a child?
Oh, yes. This is a saga. Whenever I first got into comics, I mean, for me, comics have always been around. I was a person who I was lucky enough to have an aunt who would send me boxes of old Archie comics and things like that. She would just like run out of space in her comic collection, send over a box of stuff she didn't want anymore. And of course, you know, one man's trash is another's treasure. So as a little kid, like, I was always reading comics. I just always had them around. And it was just, you know, to me, it was very normal to just constantly be reading. I lived in a rural area as a kid, so I was bored, you know, out of my mind. And so it's like you read anything that really passes, you know, your line of vision pretty much. But certainly that included a lot of kids' comics for the most part. And of course, Archie doesn't necessarily fall into the category of kids' comics anymore. But for a long time, it was kind of, even though it's like a pretty sexual comic in some ways.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all innuendo. And you're just like, haha, I don't totally get this. And then like later, you're like, what? Like,
I have a question for you. Did you, when you got into Archie as a kid, was it because of those small little Archie digests that you'd see in grocery stores? Yeah, those are awesome, right? That's how I first learned about Archie too.
Yeah, those like reprint collections that just are books, you know, like tiny little phone books full of Archie comics. Yeah, I loved those. And then of course, you know, later I turned, I think, like 10 years old and, you know, Storm from the X-Men and like all of the superheroes and a lot of independent comics followed that. And just, you know, it's just been my whole life pretty much.
Nice.
All right, everybody. So we know Sarah is legit. She's the real deal. She loves grocery store Archie, which puts her up 50 points in my book.
Heck yeah.
So we are going to go through our list of the top five queer comic book characters. Now, these lists are our opinions. There is no right or wrong. These are like, you know, what we would say would be our favorites, mm-hmm. not an objective best list. We will work through this list 5-1. And also, if you have a list out there of who you think are the top five queer comic book characters, we want to see your lists. And Ashley, where should they send our list to?
The best places that they can send their lists are, of course, on Patreon. Go ahead and comment on this post when you get it before anybody else in the world, and on Facebook.com/Geek History Lesson or on Twitter at GHL Podcast. Easiest places to find us.
Awesome. All right. I'm very excited for this list because I'm very excited to learn about some characters that maybe either I've forgotten mm-hmm. or characters that I've just never heard of before. I'm very excited about this. So let's start with our number five. Ashley,
yeah.
Who is, to you, the number five queer comic book character?
My number five is a sweet baby angel from the independent comic book world. I first heard about him on a Tumblr comic called OMG Check Please, which has since been adapted into an award-winning graphic novel series called Check Please, and that is protagonist Eric Biddle. He goes by the nickname Biddy because he's a little teeny tiny human being, and Biddy is a nice Southern boy who loves ice skating, playing hockey, and baking pies. And OMG Check Please explores his story as he moves to Samwell University, not a real university, to play on their hockey team. And as a Canadian, I was basically born having to be somewhat interested in hockey on some level. And let me tell you, OMG Check Please is my very favorite hockey thing that has ever existed. And what I super appreciate about it is this has all the trappings of sports, manga, the machismo is there, the dirty hockey mustaches and the bad hockey hair are there. All of the masculinity is on Front Street.
Ashley, can I pause you?
Yes.
As an American, is dirty hockey mustache a thing?
Oh, so it's a big thing. Welcome to Hockey Corner. It's a big thing in playoff season. If you are either competing or if your team is
competing, grow your mustache?
You don't shave until you win the Stanley Cup. So there's a terrible facial hair.
I don't watch hockey. I'm sorry.
Terrible facial hair during the playoffs. But also, that sort of Burt Reynolds mustache is a really good look if you're a hockey player to this day.
Okay.
Which I do not co-sign on. But there is a character in OMG Check Please that has it. And Eric is so amazing to me because Eric is he's small, he's very effeminate, he's very sweet. In a lot of ways, he's your adorable little Twinkie gay boy, but he's an amazing hockey player. He's really, really brave. He's open with his new friends, who you would kind of expect to be not as open about his sexuality as he wants to be, and he gets nothing but love. So I appreciate that he is presented as this pioneering character in this narrative. He's obviously the protagonist, but he is pleasantly surprised, as is the reader, by how readily he's accepted into this culture. I also really like him because he is multifaceted. The problem, and I'm saying this as a white lady in a heteronormative relationship, the problem with the portrayal of what could be viewed as minority groups in media is sometimes they are tokenized and sometimes they are one-dimensional. And Eric contains multitudes. And I just think he's so adorable. I think he's so sweet. I live for his relationship that evolves over the course of the first volume, but I don't want to spoil for you. Plus, he is a YouTube star, so what's not to like? So Eric Biddy Biddle makes my number five for being complex, real world grounded in a webcomic, and for being a sweet baby angel. I just think he's so freaking cute. A lot of these characters, I'm like, I just think they're so adorable.
The art in that comic is really good. I love the way that it looks.
And it's all done by one lady, which is incredible. Yeah. Like, I just, man, the amount of respect that I have for how hard, I believe her name is pronounced Ngozi, but I could be incorrect, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing her name. The amount of hard work that she has put into making this book as renowned as it is really, like, even if you don't think you like queer narratives, just from a production standpoint, you got to give Check Please a lot of respect. But I have talked long enough. I want to hand this over to our guest, Sarah. Who is your number five queer comic book character?
Yes. So with the disclaimer that there's a few comics, there's Love and Rockets, Safe Sex, and Lumberjanes all have so many queer characters in them that I couldn't choose one. So they didn't make my list, but people should definitely read all of those comics. My number five is Dr. Aphra from Star Wars.
Great choice.
Yeah, I love that character, and I love that Star Wars now has a disaster gay, right? Like, there's just something great about her just screwing up, you know, and messing her whole life up. All of her exes hate her, you know, like, it just makes the worst decisions again and again. And we get to see, you know, there's tons of men, tons of straight characters that, like, you know, you get to see them mess up. Dr. Aphra is definitely one of those characters where you're like, this character just really gets by on her charm. Like, her and Han Solo have, like, the same ex, you know, and it's just like, you can kind of see that Han Solo-ness about her, but she also is like a worse person than him, you know? So I think that there's something really fun about that. And to be able to actually watch a queer character who isn't bound to be a good person or, like, you know, even an okay person.
Yeah, yeah.
Who again and again just makes mistakes that are just so entertaining to watch. And it's definitely, to me, I open up a Dr. Aphra comic and it's just like, you know, it's like a roller coaster ride. You never know what she's going to do. You think you see where she's going to go, and then she just, you know, left field, you know, completely does something where it's like, not only was that the wrong thing to do, but it also didn't really make sense for you to do it. And you just did it because it was the thing that made the least sense, like, almost. So I think that that's got to be. And then, of course, you know, we talk all of the time about how bad Star Wars has been for queer representation. So the fact that there is this, you know, comic book character who hasn't quite made it to the mainstream, but I'm pretty sure she's going to.
Oh, I freaking hope so.
Oh, she's going to get a movie, I think.
Yeah. It comes up every time, right? Like, somebody's like, oh, somebody's going to do a new Star Wars property. And everybody's like, Dr. Aphra? Is it Dr. Aphra? And yeah, I just think that, like, you know, it's kind of the easiest one to go for. You know, she has her own comic saga at this point. Like, her last series ran for like 40 issues. She just started her new series. A lot of times you have these really interesting writers, beautiful art, you know, goes across the galaxy, all of the things that we love from a Star Wars comic. And, you know, she has that kind of terrifying interactions with Darth Vader, right? Like, where he very openly is going to murder her, and she's just buying time until that happens, pretty much. And I think that there's just, you know, that makes him a scarier character because she's so goofy and kind of likable and charming, and that's kind of how she gets out of all of these problems. And it's like, who would that not work on? Darth Vader, you know? So I just think that, like, you know, she brings out a lot in the other characters. Like, there's Luke Skywalker guest appearances, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Everything that you want from a Star Wars comic. But, you know, we get this fascinating new queer character out of it.
Plus murder droids.
Murder droids. I love her murder droids. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then, of course, you know, she's of Asian descent. Like, there's a lot of things that go into Aphra that to me we just don't get enough of in Star Wars. So I just think that she's a great character.
What a great pull. And I'm ashamed to say that she was not, she didn't even enter my mind when I was coming up with this list.
Me too. Again, yeah, she is a great pull.
This is what we brought Sarah on for.
Yeah.
All right. Jason, round us out. Who is your number five?
So when I was thinking about this list, I really wanted to, you know, do some research and try to figure out if there are were some queer characters out there that were in some great stories that I had just forgotten. And as Sarah so eloquently just did, I completely forgot about Dr. Aphra. So I apparently didn't do the research well enough. but there is a series back in the 90s that was published by DC Comics Vertigo called The Invisibles. And for me, my favorite character in The Invisibles is a queer character, and that is Lord Fanny from Vertigo's
what
The Invisibles.
A name.
The name's kind of questionable, but the character is so good that you can kind of get past
sure,
it.
Sure, sure. It's a drag queen name if I ever heard one.
Well, the thing to think about this is that The Invisibles was published from 1994 to 2000, and Lord Fanny, if you do not know who this character is actually, I've never heard this name said out loud, so I'm probably certain I'm going to butcher it. Hilde Morales. It might be Hilda, but mm-hmm. it's H-I-L-D-E. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to say Hilde. And if I'm wrong, everyone out there, I apologize. Hilde Morales, who's actually a shaman and a trans woman. Hilde was born male, but the storyline of Hilde is that she was raised by her grandmother, who is one of the most powerful witches in her city, who raised Hilde as a girl because their witchcraft and their magic is activated by their feminism. Basically, mm-hmm. their magic doesn't work if you're male. It only works if you're female in this storyline. So Lord Fanny's amazing because she's the most dedicated of the Invisibles, and she's also one of the only... The Invisibles are very self-serving in Grant Morrison's book because, you know, the lead Invisible is based on Grant Morrison. And Hilde is like the only one of the four that kind of would do anything to protect the others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Has a very strong element of, you know, flamboyant drag queen, but she uses it very much well to make enemies underestimate her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like she makes it feel in a lot of the storylines like, oh, it's about my looks and it's about the dress and it's about my wig. And so that makes enemies overestimate her when actually she's sort of like, my theory is like, I've always said that Sue Storm is the most powerful member of the Fantastic Four. Lord Fanny is actually the most powerful member of the Invisibles. And it's amazing that she draws her powers from Mayan cosmology and the God of Death.
Everything that Grant Morrison was really into at
exactly,
the time.
Exactly. Yeah. but I just think it's fascinating when I was thinking about this list that like this character from 1994 who is a very visible trans queer character and is secretly the most powerful member of the team. And I think there's something quite amazing in that. And that's why Lord Fanny is my number five.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very
Lord
nice.
Fanny is a great character. It's like there's, you know, being of the time it is, there's things that don't age super well. But then
exactly.
there's also
yes.
things where you're like, wow, this was in a comic in like the mid 90s. That's kind of amazing.
Yeah. Published by DC of all companies.
Yeah, totally.
You know, Vertigo was secretly like very queer when you think about it, especially with Constantine,
yeah.
who I'm sure is going to come up at some point in our discussion.
Right.
So that's very cool. I haven't read The Invisible, so not a pick I would have made.
Yeah.
Yay, I was worried there was going to be a lot of crossover, but we're off to a good start.
Mm-hmm. All right, Ashley, how about you kick us off for your number four?
My number four is not a Western character because even though at the time of this recording, hopefully this is different in the future. Hello, future people. Japan is not as culturally open to the queer community as we are in America, or perhaps like to think we are in America. Anime and manga is low-key very queer, which is excellent. And mm-hmm. even though I know a lot of people, especially listeners, are expecting me to go for a Sailor Moon reference here, the first manga character that I knew was queer was Yukito Tsukishiro, crushed that name, who you may also know as Yue or Julian from Cardcaptor Sakura. And he is the boyfriend slash best friend, if you're watching the American version, of Sakura's brother Toya. And his alter ego, Yue, is this beautiful ethereal angel who helps Sakura on her journey to become the master of the cloud cards. In a lot of ways, he is a representative of your magical gay stereotype, where his sexuality and his more effeminate leanings literally fuel his magic and his magical alter ego. However, he plays such an important role in the overall mythology of the world and is empowered by his queerness that I think it's amazing that he exists at all. He also opens up a lot of other gay relationships in the world. Like I said, he is Toya's boyfriend by the end of the series and his love interest, Shouron, who they called Lee in the English dub. The younger boy has a crush on Yue, although they walk it back a little bit later by being like, no, he was attracted to his magical powers. And you're like, just let him be gay. It'll be okay. And so even though the magical gay has definitely become a stereotype and sometimes a crutch of fantasy, I think Yukito is a really great example of that. I think he is literally beautiful in both of his forms. He's so powerful. And I like that his queerness puts him at the center of this mythology as a leader and as a mentor to our magical girl. And I really wanted to make sure that when we were doing this list, that it wasn't just Western comics and it wasn't just modern to the last 5 years comics. We always like to have a lot of diverse reading options. So Yukito Tsukishiro, sorry about the last name, never gonna get it, is my number four for both of his personas and for all of the power and possibilities that he brings to Cardcaptor Sakura. All right, Sarah, we are going to spin the roulette wheel back to you and ask, who is your number four?
Yeah, so my number four is actually a Marvel Comics character.
Nice.
It is Richter, who is from X-Factor and X-Force and a little bit of the New Mutants. He was introduced to the comics as a teenager, and he was kind of a disaffected punk kid. Highly relatable for me right away. And, you know, terrible haircut. I love you. You know, exactly the person who I am. I like him a lot because I think that there was just a long process for him. You know, a lot of it was subtext for a while. You know, he had kind of this relationship with Shatterstar, who was his teammate, you know, and, you know, teammate almost in quotation marks in and of itself. But like, they kind of had this close friendship relationship, but it wasn't made explicit. You know, a lot of these comics are mm-hmm. very subtext heavy for a really long time. He became one of the first like on panel same-sex kisses in comics, like mainstream comics especially, and it was with Shatterstar. So they have this really interesting relationship. You know, I believe that Shatterstar would maybe identify as pansexual, whereas Richter at first thinks he is bisexual and then, you know, kind of goes on this kind of journey, and I believe now he identifies as gay. But it was a struggle, you know? So I think that as much as that's frustrating to read, I grew up on X-Men comics, and like the amount of subtext in a lot of those comics is pretty overwhelming. And you have characters like Mystique, you know, like, I mean, and like just so many Kate Pryde, you know, so many characters where you're just like, I'm pretty sure that this character is at least, you know, bisexual.
Hop over to an alternate universe and Colossus is gay in a really, really moving story.
Yeah, that's actually a really good story. I'm very questionable on the Ultimate Universe, but I think that Colossus's arc there was actually really great. And yeah, you know, it changes a lot. And you know, now we have a few more openly gay characters or openly queer characters, so that's always nice. But you know, for me, Richter kind of suffered along with me, right? Like, there was kind of this time where I was like, I'm reading these comics. I also, like, for a while, you know, this isn't everybody's journey. It was my journey. Like, but my journey was basically, like, for a while, I was like, I think I'm bisexual. And then, you know, eventually it was kind of like, nah, I'm gay. Like, I'm just going to stick to that. I think I've tried to, like, you know, thought experiment my way out of this situation, but I'm pretty much just gay. And, like, I think that he kind of goes through the same thing. And, you know, the person that he's in love with is kind of, you know, a polyamorous person and, like, who's, like, interested in a lot of people and a lot of experiences. So that makes him kind of the sad guy punk, you know, who's, like, who's, like, kind of just, like, just, like, you know, wish that Shatterstar was here. And Shatterstar's, like, off having a great time, you know. And, like, all of those things I just think are, it's just kind of moving. And we don't really see enough of that character, but I do love him. And I love that he was around for so long and kind of had this kind of troubled arc that, you know, just was great. And also he's, you know, one of the few Mexican characters in X-Force, you know, in any of these, in any of the X titles, in any mainstream comics. So, you know, it's like diversity all around. And I just kind of love that guy. So, yeah, he's my number four.
I'm so glad that you shared that story about how it related to your own journey as well, because we talk a lot about representation and why it matters, and being able to see something that is like yourself, even if it is someone of a completely different gender who is an X person, is really important.
Right. And I mean, just the fact that, like, it's like Richter's story kind of happens because of bad writing in a way. Like, it happens in this, like, people are just like, they don't really know what to do with him.
Sounds like a lot of X-Men comics.
That's very true. And it's just like, you know, sometimes that's how you feel, you know, it's like I'm being written by a terrible writer and, like, I don't know where I'm going, you know?
Yeah, who's,
and,
like, you kind of have to edit 2020 because we need a new draft on this.
Sometimes you have to take control of your own narrative. And I think that, like, I got to experience Richter doing that, you know, kind of in real time alongside myself. So,
aw. All right, Jason, need you to round out. Number four.
Well, we're not going to leave the X-Men universe. I'm going to tell you that.
Oh, boy. Colossus, right?
No. Actually, my character is a character that didn't really present to me as a queer character until very recently, actually, in the most recent Jonathan Hickman X-Men run. And that is Mystique.
Mm-hmm. Who, yes. Oh, my God. Yep.
Yeah. And the reason why, I mean, Mystique is bisexual because Mystique, through a lot of the 90s, they tended to be, they would play Mystique as, like, she's the villainess, but she's also the villainess that will sleep with Wolverine. And she got reduced to, like, just cliche storytelling. And Jonathan Hickman in House of X and Powers of X brought back this sort of dangling plot thread that was introduced, actually, I looked this up, was introduced in Uncanny X-Men 265 in 1990. This comic introduced that Mystique and Destiny, who is sort of this mutant psychic who can foresee the future.
Aren't they all?
That was the comic that confirmed that they've had a love affair for years. And Jonathan Hickman kind of brought that back and was like, no, Mystique and Destiny are a couple. They kind of act like they're married. And in some of the most recent issues of Jonathan Hickman's X-Men, Mystique is seen kind of being the troublemaker, because at this point in current X-Men history, slight spoilers, they're living on the mutant island of Krakoa, and Charles Xavier and Magneto is trying to create, like, this sort of peaceful Malcolm X and Martin Luther King living together atmosphere. And Mystique kind of seems like she's going to be the person that might burn it all down, but she's going to burn it all down because right now Krakoa has this rule that, like, psychics are not allowed. Precogs, yes, thank you. People that can tell the future are not allowed, and Destiny falls in that category. Mm-hmm. And Mystique is getting angrier and angrier and angrier. Actually, I think it's one of the best scenes Mystique's ever had in her entire storytelling career, where she's screaming about, you're gonna give me my love.
Yeah.
I want my wife back.
My wife back. I want my wife back.
That is just, like, there's no queer comic reader that does not have that, like, just seared into their mind.
Someone's been on a t-shirt by now, right?
Yeah.
God, yeah, I would buy it. Yeah, for sure.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, before this kind of modern reimagining by Jonathan Hickman, you know, I Mystique, you know, like she got a pretty good, I would say, plot line in some of the movies. She got, you know, her importance got bumped up. But she's also, she's just kind of always been this shape-shifty, evil...
Sexy lady.
Sexy lady, yes, who is may or may not be Nightcrawler's. That was a big mystery mother for a long time until they finally confirmed it. But I actually love this version of Mystique. I think making her sort of the spouse of, or making her the spouse of Destiny really adds something to her character, and I think makes her more real. And to me, that is what made her my number four queer comic book character, because I was like, when you use a character's sexuality not as a token, mm-hmm. but as like a true powerful way to tell a story. That's when it's just not like, oh, she's queer or bisexual, that's cool. No, it's like she's queer and bisexual, and that's a powerful, important part of her character. That's what I love, and that's why Mystique made it onto my number four.
Nice.
Oh, and I want to say too that that was a painful art, kind of like, because there's in the early Claremont days, like there's a pretty obvious relationship happening between Destiny and Mystique. Destiny's obviously much older, but Mystique's, or she appears much older, and Mystique is a shapeshifter, so she never has to age.
Yeah, so she's 145 years old.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So like, but she, you know, you think of her as being younger, but it's like, it's such a beautiful story to think of, like, the person who won't leave you, you know, like the person who doesn't have to age and still just stays with you up until your very last moments. And it kind of went on from there. Like, there were times where even before it was confirmed or outside of it being confirmed, like, you just saw all of this subtext all of the time, whenever Mystique would pop up, unless it was one of those stories of like, well, now she is being sexy with this guy or whatever. But there were like, there were comics, there's like one comic, and I don't remember what issue it is, but Rogue talks about Mystique and Destiny. She's at a wedding and she's like, I wonder what would have happened if my moms could have been married, or if it, that would have changed Aww. Anything for them. Mm-hmm. And that's just, I mean, that's so heartbreaking. And so, and then of course, you know, in like the Wolverines comic, there's this wonderful story arc where like we find out that Mystique is certainly willing to let the entire universe end if it means that she gets to spend another minute with Destiny. And so it's like, to me, those are, it's kind of hard to be like, well, that's like subtext, you know, because it's like that's text, you know, at that point,
you know. But I wonder I'm sorry to interrupt, I wonder
no.
if that was a thing of I wonder if Marvel editors, yeah. that was as far as they would let them go.
It's true. Yeah. You know? Jim Shooter. Like, and I can't, you know, you can't totally blame Jim Shooter, because there were national laws against distributing queer material. So like, you know, it wasn't so, you know, long ago that, you know, Batman and Robin being accused of being gay by Frederick Wortham had almost completely ended the comics industry. So, I mean, you can't, it's like, as tempting as it is to be like, yeah, Jim Shooter's a big meanie, you know, like, in, you know, in many cases I would be able to say that, but,
that. I think we allow
yeah,
that.
But you know, in this, it's like, it's a much more complicated situation. Like, yeah. you know, there was, you couldn't distribute queer material. Like, that was a big thing. Like, you, there's stories from back then of people being like, yeah, I couldn't get, like, you know, my comics, like, there were underground comics that would have queer subject matter, and, you know, it would be really hard. You had to, like, really hide that you were mailing those things because there were laws against it.
And now people have Patreons to fund them. What a beautiful yeah. world.
Yeah. A lovely arc.
All right, Ashley.
Yes.
We are up to your number three.
Halfway up the list.
Who is your number trace?
My number trois is a character that I only know about because Mr. Jason Inman put the book that they appear in the most in my hands, and that is The Shining Knight. Now, I am specifically talking about the third incarnation of The Shining Knight. The best shorthand I can give you is that they appeared in the Seven Soldiers series from the New 52. The Shining Knight version before then was a knight called Sir Justin. When Grant Morrison rebooted it, They changed their name to the spelling from an anglicized Justin to Y-S-T-I-N, which I'm assuming is Yeastin. I'm not Welsh. It's the Welsh version of Justin. And they do appear to be an assigned female at birth character. And in the beginning, it's played like a joke, like, no, I'm a man, call me sir, no, I'm a knight, I'm a man, treat me like a man. And even though I don't always appreciate a comedic address of somebody's identity, whether that be sexual or racial or anything else, it is a period piece, so they probably would have said way worse things to this character if they actually existed. And of course, there were trans and gender fluid and non-binary people throughout history. But what I do appreciate about the fact that Sir Yeastin puts this on Front Street from the beginning is that later on down the line, there is literally a line where they say, when someone asks, are you a man or a woman? They say, I am the other two. I was born this way. I've kept saying, whenever anyone asks, I'm not just a man or a woman. I am both. And having a character who is playing such a traditionally masculine role in such a patriarchal time, but is an objective badass, because the Shining Knight is a badass. And definitely.
And with a cool horse.
Has an amazing horse. It definitely levels up over the course of their adventures. But having them be this self-aware for the sake of the readers as much for the sake of the reality that they live in, I think is amazing. I just love Shining Knight so freaking much. There was no way they were not going to make it onto my list. I think they deserve every adaptation in the world. I think they deserve a TV show and a movie. And I'm so glad that Grant Morrison, who Jason also referenced in The Invisibles, was able to take this Prince Valiant type character who's been around the DC universe for a long time and update them. And like with Mystique, use this factor of their identity as a way to tell more compelling, more interesting stories in the world that they're set against. It's not just a tokenization. And I am sure, like with Lord Fanny, when we get 15 and 20 years past the story, we're going to look back at it and be like, ooh, that was a little ham-fisted. Ooh, that was and maybe not in the best taste. But I do appreciate it because we don't see a lot of gender fluid or non-binary characters in comics. And Sir Yeastin is a great example of
I want to point out a couple just clarifications because, yeah, the series I gave you was
Demon Knights.
No. It was Seven Soldiers of Victory. That was a pre-New 52. And it's interesting because Grant Morrison built the story around the reveal of the identity, but it wasn't until Demon Knights. So in the Seven Soldiers of Victory, you learn that, is it Yeastin?
I don't know what the Welsh pronunciation of it is, so I'm saying Yeastin, and somebody from Yeastin. Wales will tell me I'm wrong.
So you found out Yeastin was female, and then, yeah, in Demon Knights, they did the thing where, it was especially through Etrigan the Demon, like Etrigan the Demon was always unsure, like, are you a boy, are you a girl? But they just ran with it for like 30 issues, And then kind of Yeastin is almost the most powerful member of the Demon Knights, mm-hmm. or the most capable. But yes, I agree with you. Like that, I love that character a lot. And I think that update, that's a perfect update to a character that is kind of dopey and kind of silly.
Yeah.
And then when you give it this kind of, for lack of a better term, like plot juice, it really not only like makes it a more well-rounded character, but it really makes it a lot more contemporary, because a medieval knight is not that contemporary.
Right. Also, DC mm-hmm. Collectibles, I'm looking at you. Please make a Shining Knight action figure.
With Pegasus.
One. So bad. All right.
I would like to note that there is a Shelf Dust series. Shelf Dust is a website that does comics criticism that did Seven Soldiers of Victory with seven different critics doing all of the different. Now, I did Mr. Miracle, which I was actually not very fond of and kind of unfortunately had to call out some of Grant Morrison's worst moments in. But
no writer is perfect. Absolutely.
Of course. Yeah. The critic who tackled Shining Knight was Emma Hubois, who is a great comic critic. And everybody should read that.
We will link to it. Thank you.
Yeah. So number three, is that where we're
yes,
at?
Yes,
Sarah, we are ready for your number three.
Yes. All right. Well, I'm going to choose. I mean, mine are all mainstream superheroes because that's pretty much what I've read the most of. But it's going to be Etta Candy from the Wonder Woman franchise.
Yes, I love her.
Yes, I'm obsessed with Etta Candy. I actually wrote an article about her pretty recently. So just to hear me more, do some more ranting and raving about how much I love this character, you can always look at Sci-Fi Fangirls for that. But in the meantime, I can tell you here, Etta Candy was introduced alongside Wonder Woman. She has been in the comic for a really long time. She is, you know, a woman who just like, is so dynamic. You know, it's every time she appears on screen or on panel, you're just like, yes, it's her again. This is amazing. You know, it's like, she's like fat, beautiful, proud, like, you know, so body positive, doesn't take anything. Like, people come at her with any number of insults and she's like, absolutely not. Like, I'm Etta Candy. Yeah. And I'm the best friend of Diana Prince. Like, you know, so it's like, she's just amazing. And so it took a really long time. Like, there was, you know, the early days of Wonder Woman, which, you know, we talk about a lot as being like, yeah, those were like a little kinky. They had like the, you know, the golden lasso and like all the tying up and like all of that stuff. But they were also, you know, infused with a lot of feminism. And so that is cool. There's a lot of good things and a lot of bad things about those comics. But Etta Candy is the great thing about those comics. And, you know, later they switched editorial and they switched vision with Wonder Woman. So for years and years and years, it was just like boring, terrible, like Wonder Woman is a secretary to the Justice League instead of like in the Justice League and like all of these like stories that are just kind of grating. And then you have Etta Candy, of course, like they just made her be a little bit thinner, a little bit more waifish, like, you know, a little like a petite, like shy character who's like obsessed with candy and like can't speak without referencing candy and like just kind of just like they went such a wrong direction with her. But more recently, we've seen her come back to the comics and she is, you know, openly queer. Like, she was in a relationship with Barbara Minerva, the cheetah, who I also love, and who is going to be in Wonder Woman 84.
At some point.
Yeah, at some point. We'll see how that goes. And of course, like, you know, it's hard to say, like, Barbara Minerva was a character who was like, you know, disabled and like had a lot of like interesting kind of like just British colonialism, like kind of put into her story. And so there was a lot of things about her, like her bisexuality, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that that's actually going to make it to the screen, but she's also a really interesting character. Etta Candy being out now is huge because the Wonder Woman franchise has such a history of being so gay and not gay, right? Like, it's like homoerotic and homophobic, like both at the same time. Like, she's from an island of Amazons. Like, there's, you know, you think that it's going to be a lot more queer than it is. And then when you read it, you're just kind of like, I mean, I guess like we care about Steve Trevor, but like, you know, what's happening here kind of. Etta to me is the character that, you know, turns all that around a lot of the time. And so when you see her written well, you know, showing up in this like great friendship role to Diana and then, you know, having interest in of her own, you know, having interest in other women outside of that. And like just all of the story to me is, I love that character, you know. So I think that she's a great character that we could definitely use more of. But what we have is good.
I co-sign on this so hard. It is amazing and truly only gets better the more modern and the more progressive that the writers become behind
right,
her.
Now she's black. Like, they like changed. Yeah. She was started as like a white character with blonde hair. Also love that version. But like, yeah, totally. It's like now she's, you know, black, queer. It's like still there's like military stuff going on, which is not always my favorite thing to read about. But like, I mean, she's great.
I'm so glad too that you talked about the one thing about all DC comic characters is the multiple iterations, because that was something I was gonna ask you. I was like, which version is your favorite? And then you covered it all, so I was like, oh great.
Yeah, there's definitely like a 40-year period where I'm like, what are you guys doing? Yeah. Like, I mean, that's, when I read Wonder Woman comics.
That's mm-hmm. Very. Our listeners to the podcast will remember our Wonder Woman: The Golden Age series.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Where you're like, this is like half really good and half really terrible.
Yeah. There's tons of problems. That's certainly its own podcast, as you just mentioned. But yeah.
Okay, Jason,
yes.
Time to round out the number threes.
Well, for my number three, I figured I have to be somebody on this podcast has got to be pretty obvious. These are the obvious choices. and it's two people, and I'm counting them as one because to me it's hard to think about one without the other. I, of course, am talking about Midnighter and Apollo. Now, these are, of course, Wildstorm characters that debuted in 1998 in Stormwatch. Of course, Midnighter is basically Wildstorm's Batman. He has the ultimate technician, and then Apollo is basically Superman who absorbs the sun even better than Superman can. But basically, they are, in a lot of respects, the gay Superman and Batman. And the reason why I wanted to include them in this list is that when they were initially introduced, a lot of people thought, and a lot of comic book journalists and all this stuff like that, thought it was a gimmick and a joke. And you thought that, like, oh, it's the gag of, like, what would be if Batman and Superman kissed? Ha, 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 ha. But we're 20 years later, and these characters are still around. They have not disappeared. And I was trying to figure out, why do I think that these two characters, who, honestly, when they were pitched, I guarantee you was pitched as a joke.
They're pastiches, for sure.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I think the reason why is because of some of the more recent series. But even in their original debut, a lot of focus is given to that, yes, Midnighter is just a despicable person, and Apollo is willing to murder people left and right. But a lot of their storylines or scenes all deal with their marriage to each other. And one of the Mark Miller's early Authority stories actually deals with the fact that they are protecting this young baby, mm-hmm. this young Jenny Sparks. And they're, you know, there's a lot of scenes where Apollo and Midnighter will, like, take any hit or do anything as long as they protect the baby and raising the baby. And there leads to all these conversations about what are we going to do once we get past this, or what are we going to do once we survive? And it's like, oh, let's just sit by the beach. Let's do the thing. And Steve Orlando also has done a pretty good job, I think, in some of the more recent series by making these two characters very real gay men. And I think, again, like, that's the reason why I wanted to include them on this list, because they so easily could have just been jokes. They so easily could have been just thrown away. But the fact that they've been around for 20 years, I think, should say something to the power of their story and the power of, there must be a huge fan base out there that identifies with these two guys. For lack of a better term, the gay Superman and the gay Batman.
They make each other better. They are at their best when they're together.
Yes, you are correct. And that's the reason why I included them as one. I don't think you can talk about one without the other. But I actually do think there are a lot of good Midnighter and Apollo story. I think they have grown past their original pastiche.
The joke, yeah.
Yes, the joke of their creation. And I think that's the reason why I include Midnighter and Apollo as my number three.
Nice choice.
Mm-hmm. I love them.
I almost put them on my list, and I know we're going to get into the also-rans eventually, but I almost put them mm-hmm. on my list.
Yeah. All right, Ashley, we're here to the number two.
We are.
Who is your number two?
My number two is a character I think I've put on several many list episodes.
I think you have.
Here on Geek History Lesson. They are my only Marvel Comics contribution to this list. And it is the son of the Scarlet Witch himself, Wiccan. I should have been like Jason and counted Wiccan and Hulkling as one mm-hmm. because
they are
introduced as such, sort of inexorably tied together. But you know what? We're going to do another episode at some point in the future that's going to be best queer couples.
Ashley, I'm going to stop you right here. Do you like Wiccan better than Hulkling?
I do.
Okay.
I do like Wiccan better than Hulkling.
I'm just curious.
I love them both so much.
I mean, it's nothing against Teddy. I just like, I love a witch. So
yeah.
He's a witch. He's also truly looks like all the comic book characters I had crushes on when I was like 12 or 13. So he sits like right in just so many of my personal wheelhouses. He mm-hmm. was one of the first like fully realized gay characters that I saw in a mainstream comic who behaved like a normal person. His sexuality is not represented in a stereotypical way or in an annoying way, and it's not played for jokes. I do think it hasn't been used to its greatest effect. Billy and Teddy have been engaged for about 100,000 years, and I just wish that they would get married, but I know we want to keep them as children because we're going to put them in a Young Avengers movie with Kamala Khan that we're going to spin out of the Miss Marvel show, but I would just really love to see them progressed. And I went to a performing arts high school in Canada. I knew boys like Billy in real life in my adolescence, and he just makes me so happy. He is such a positive role model. He is a leader in the Young Avengers. He's a leader of his peers who can go toe-to-toe with adult Avengers, including his just wild mother and father. He's self-assured, and he's in a loving relationship. And not all on the spectrum romances, and by that I mean the sexuality spectrum, they don't always get a happy ending. And Billy and Teddy are not perfect. They definitely have conflict, but their relationship has always felt loving and mature to me in a way that we all hope to have by the time we're 17 and don't usually get until several many decades later. And that's something that I think a lot more creators could strive for in their younger characters, and specifically in their queer characters. Please just let them get married. I want them to get married. I need them to get married. I want that cover. And he's a magical witch. So, like, what more could you want? And kind of like Jason talked about with Lord Fanny, a lot of witchcraft and witch traditions are tied to a feminine side of you or your feminine energy. And I love that the Young Avengers kind of flips it and they give the witch, traditional witch powers to a male character as opposed to his mom, the Scarlet Witch, on a classic Avengers team. So I love him so much, and there's no way he was not going to be on my list. And so it's got to be Wicked at my number two.
I also love Wiccan so much. I've just been like sitting here quietly, like with hearts in my eyes, because I really love that character. Hulkling too. His mom too. I love Scarlet Witch. I'm a stand for all of these characters.
Nice.
My number two is going to be who probably is my favorite character in comics. Didn't make it to my number one for a couple of reasons I'm going to talk about.
Fair.
But it's going to be Poison Ivy, Dr. Pamela Isley.
Nice.
So I am just my favorite character. Like, if there's a character that I like relate to in a way that makes me slightly uncomfortable, it's going to be this character. Definitely slightly murderous, and yet, you know, in a way that you can kind of empathize with at times, because there's a lot of environmentalism behind, you know, her ideology. And again, there's a lot of struggle with her. Like, she's kind of had to come to terms with her sexuality, and it's been a journey. Like, it's not something that was just easy for her. And you can see her struggle with it over time. And of course, a lot of that, once again, is because writers were adhering to, you know, really strict editorial that wasn't down with, you know, probably even as much queerness as it was getting away with. But, you know, I mean, there was just, I look back on her story with Harley, and I just think that there's so much to it. Like, there's just so much important stuff, because it's two women who are completely traumatized, and, you know, both of them feel like they're broken and, like, you know, monstrous in a way that, you know, is irredeemable. They're not ever going to be able to come back from it. And with each other, they do come back from it. And you start to see this kind of heroic side to both of them. And once, you know, once you team them up, like once you team Harley up with Ivy in like the animated series, and they did it in the comics as well, in the beginning, you know, Harley is just reeling from trauma. Like, she has just gotten out of her relationship with the Joker. Mm-hmm. And that makes it almost impossible to villainize Ivy, because Ivy is there for her in such a, you know, kind of inobtrusive but very emphatic way. Like, definitely making it clear that she's there for her, and gets frustrated with Harley for, like, going back to this guy who's terrible. And, yeah, it was, to me, it's just, I look at that relationship as being so symbolic of what a lot of people go through. Like, you go through these, you know, horrible relationships, or you have, you know, abusive relationships. And when you get out of that, you know, it's like, where do you go from there? You had this, you know, in the case of Harley and the Joker, that's something that really consumed a lot of who Harley was, and she's struggling to find herself again. And then, you know, she doesn't immediately hook up with Ivy, but, like, they become friends. And then, you know, that turns into a relationship down the line. But it's like the amount of not asking each other for much, you know, is kind of something that I think is really beautiful in their relationship, and just the way that they've had to heal together and how they grow together. Like, that to me is something that is so gorgeous. Just, you don't see stories like that in comics, or really at all, you know, because I think that you know, I mean, from the beginning, we villainized those characters. Like Ivy was, introduced as kind of a one-dimensional, sexy villain. And then over time, you start to see that she's really passionate about saving the Earth, and that like she just sees billionaires do terrible things to the planet, and that makes her angry and she lashes out. And maybe it's not always great, but I think that it's a lot more relatable today than it was, you know, in like the 60s when people were like, look at her, she's out of control. And now we're just kind of like, was she?
Because it seemed like in hysterics.
those guys that were trying to destroy the marsh actually seemed like they might have been the villains of this story. So yeah, it's like you start to empathize with them, and they're also two characters. They've changed a lot over time. Obviously, Harley is a much more recent character than Ivy, but their evolution together is what makes both of those characters to me. Like, obviously, I love Birds of Prey and like Harley being on her own and kind of, you know, finding her girl gang and like, you know, becoming empowered by that. That's an important story. You know, of course, like you can't be in an empowered relationship without becoming empowered on your own first. But like, Ivy is also such a big part of that, and Harley's such a big part of that for Ivy. And like, I just love everything about that. And it's a character who's just been dismissed and blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, and even now, if you talk to anybody, like if you talk to any Harley and Ivy shippers online, like we're all very upset, you know, because like they're constantly just writing those characters out of the book. And like, you know, they're like, oh, like, look at this, they're best friends again or something. And like, they just use a lot of that, like gal pal, roommate, besties, you know, kind of language around those two characters,
which is so funny because for so many of us who I think came up, like especially in the 90s with the Batman the Animated Series, we're like, oh yeah, they're married, probably
their body language towards
they
each other
because it's the same bed.
I think it was the episode Gotham Knights.
Yeah
it's like that. We talk, it's like I was shocked whenever I looked back on that, to be like, because I think about it and I'm just like, oh, you know, like subtext, I must have been reading, like I'm gay, so I must have been reading gay stuff into things. And then I like look back and I'm just like, their body language is so sexual towards each other that it's like, no, this is a couple. Like, you can't avoid it. Like, there's no getting out of that. Like, the way that they were trying to portray these characters was as a queer couple. And, you know, they had a lot of problems. And, like, Harley was always going back to her terrible boyfriend and, like, all of that. But they were still a queer couple. And, like, that's, you know, we deserve to have complicated queer couples. So I don't know, everything about them I love. I love the lessons I've been able to take from them. I love the fandom that's come up around them, you know, and I love that they've changed over time. Like, you know, now we had like the Harley Quinn series, which is like essentially just a love story between those two. And so it's just like, the way that that's changed and become something that's more on the screen, you know, something that we actually see and can be like, look, I wasn't, you know, making things up in the mid 90s as like a gay 10-year-old, you know, like I saw something that was there that like, you know, even they maybe were still struggling through. And I think that that, you know, I love that story. Although, once again, lots of problems in the comics where you're just like, you know, it's rough. It's rough to be a fan of those two sometimes, but I just love them.
All of all the Harley and Ivy action figures that we have, I always make hold hands because it's the law.
They have to. And it's like, that's more important, right? Because it's like, you look at Harley as like the deranged girlfriend of the Joker, and that's like, it's not that interesting.
No,
you know?
And I mean, look, I mean, DC's just proved that they could just replace her with anyone else in that role. So
exactly,
they did just prove
that. Yeah.
And it's like, you look at Ivy as like the classic femme fatale. Who cares about that stuff anymore? Like, that was sexist in the 30s. Like, you know, it's like we're in the 20s, like the 2020s now. You know, we have to get rid of those stereotypes. And so it's like, you bring them together and they become so much more. And it's like that, we've talked about that with a lot of these couples, but they're both just amazing queer characters that I love a lot.
So Jason, is your number two also going to be two people?
No, but mine is a character that I think for a long time was written as if they were two people. And now that this character is finally being written as the way it should be, my number two is an old lad from Liverpool, John Constantine.
I love John Constantine.
Yay!
That is my number two. And John Constantine, of course, he's the warlock, as you will, of the DC Universe, originally introduced in this Swamp Thing, Saga of the Swamp Thing, then showed up in Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Not unproblematically
fun fact, one of three characters in the DC Universe that remembers Crisis on Infinite Earths. There's my nerd hat. Okay. But John Constantine is one of these characters that back in Hellblazer number 51 in 1992 dropped this line. Girlfriends, the old boyfriend, they all have a nasty habit of walking out on me. And ever since then, to me, it was like the door to bisexuality for John Constantine had been open wide. And it took a bit longer until Brian Azzarello's Ashes and Dust, where they treated the character's queerness as sort of matter and fact. And then, of course, recently, James Tynion IV, who is also a bisexual himself and guest of this podcast, literally did a Constantine series that talked about his fluid attraction and everything like that. And then if you look at the last season, season four of Legends of Tomorrow, which John Constantine is a character, the main crux of the season is John Constantine's love story with his boyfriend Desmond. And the fact that one of the cruxes of the season is that John Constantine cannot save the timeline until he makes up and kisses Desmond. And the fact that it is accepted, I love the idea that watching this character that was just sort of introduced as sort of this rogue, sort of this con man, very Sawyer from Lost kind of idea, and now it is just fully accepted that, like, yeah, John Constantine is into everything.
Including on Legends of Tomorrow, fellow bisexual star Sarah Lance.
Exactly. And I actually love, because I think it makes that character better, especially when you look at a character like John Constantine, where the fact that John Constantine is a con man that will do anything to win, it does make sense that he would have fluid sexuality as well, that that would be part of his bag of tricks. But it has also allowed John Constantine to tell some very, especially Legends of Tomorrow season four, his love story with Desmond is very strong and one of the strongest plot lines of that season. And so I just love, I love this character that I remember from my childhood just being sort of, I don't know, cranky Merlin with blonde hair, has now become this character sort of filled with love. Mm-hmm. Like, he has become this romantic character. And I think there's something powerful that they're now using his queerness to tell these very powerful love stories with John Constantine. And that's why he's my number two.
Nice choice.
The Tynion run on Constantine with Ming Doyle's amazing, amazing art. And Oliver, the boyfriend who I loved.
Yes.
He was the best. And I loved their relationship with each other. And I also love, once again, you know, I already had one disaster gay on
I was going to say, here's another one.
Yeah,
this
true,
is
true.
Disaster bisexual for sure. And, you know, I love, once again, he's a character where it's like constantly makes terrible mistakes and, you know, constantly causes the deaths of people that are really close to him and has just an ongoing issue, like trying to get close to people that, like, you know, I mean, Oliver was like a little too good for him and he still goes for it because he's romantic. And it's actually, yeah, I mean, everything you said, he's a beautiful, wonderful character.
I mean, low key, like, aren't we all also too good for John Constantine, but we definitely date him?
Yeah.
No, Zatanna. I think it's the opposite, right? So, yeah. We're all too good for John Constantine.
We're all the Zatanna of that relationship.
I do love that relationship.
Well, that's the thing, same. Too. It's very interesting now, kind of what you were talking about with Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy and the Joker, that they now, there's this Constantine thing with, it's usually Constantine, his boyfriend, and then the Zatanna is always on the other side.
Yeah. Look, they just have they just have to, like, Summers family it up and start a throuple. It'll be fine.
I'd be down.
Throuple.
All right, Ashley.
Yeah.
The moment has come.
Okay.
We are now here to number one. Who is, in your opinion, the number one queer comic book character?
So I originally, in an early draft, had this person at number five. But they are my highest profile character. So I feel like they deserve to be at number one. They are a character whose queer identity was not confirmed, but very much inferred until the modern age. But I think as long as I knew them and I knew that they lived on an island of all women, they were going to be kissing women. And that's Wonder Woman Diana Prince. And it's something that is only satisfactorily explored in certain stories. I would definitely give Earth One a lot of credit for exploring her relationship with other women in a nice way. It was something I really wish they were going to do in the movies. I don't mind, again, no knock on Steve Trevor, but I really wanted Diana to, like, kiss her girlfriend as she was leaving Themyscira.
They still might. At the time of this recording, we have not seen Wonder Woman 84.
Yeah, I mean, we could at
hopefully
some point, but Paradise Island, Themyscira, the Amazons have always, always been very, very gay. And so, of course, Diana would be. Diana is arguably one of the strongest members of the DC universe, let alone the Justice League. She's also a symbol of love. And I will not say purity because, like, that has weird, I'm going to use the same word, puritanical overtures. And Diana is a very healthy sexualized character. When it is done the right way, that's really great. When it's done the wrong way, it's really unfortunate. But she's, like, definitely a lady with a healthy sex life. And I like that everything about her identity emboldens her and she is able to embrace, and it makes her a better superhero and then ultimately a better icon. She's not beaten down by any part of the queer narrative that she has been given in fiction. And I also love that, and the movie does touch on this a little bit, I love that, so not only is she raised by the whole, right, like, it takes a village, so she's raised by the whole island, but we know that Hippolyta has, if not a wife, then a girl. She has a partner. And I love that, like, Diana comes out as the strongest woman in this world, having been raised by a gaggle of mothers. I think that's so beautiful. And Wonder Woman is another character who I always put on my list. Just, she's so important and she's so wonderful. And in a lot of ways, she is this idealized version, right, of what a queer woman would be in comics. But sometimes we need heroes that are unattainably amazing. So
Ashley,
we can keep striving.
May I ask you a question?
Sure.
Am I remembering this wrong? In the Wonder Woman Earth One graphic novel by Grant Morrison, did they make Nubia the Black Wonder Woman Hippolyta's wife? Am I remembering that wrong?
It's not.
That's Philippus.
Yes.
It's, excuse me. Yes. Yeah.
Who's played by Anne Ogbomo of Krypton fame.
Yes, in the movie.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. No, but Nubia, man, we need more Nubia in this.
Because Nubia's in a book too as well, I've heard.
Yeah.
She is queer in Wonder Woman 77 too.
Yeah.
Nubia is. Yes. I was curious, have either of you read Wonder Woman, The One True Amazon?
I have.
Yeah.
Right, with Jill Thompson,
yes.
Right? So that, to me, is
the best,
super queer
the best
story.
Eisner
yes,
Award
oh my
winning.
God.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. Well, she has that friend that she's trying to impress the entire story. Mm-hmm. And I think of that one because I'm just like, that, to me, it's like this story where it's like, at no point is she like, I have a huge crush on this girl. But it's like, you just see it in all of her actions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, however they got past, however they got past any kind of censorship, I always read that one and I'm just like, no, Diana is very bisexual. Like, she's super into this girl.
Yes. But it also just makes sense, right? Like, I remember before everyone was like across the board, like on co-signing on it. It was like, but she's from Paradise Island. They can only have girlfriends.
I mean, yeah, it makes quite logical sense.
Yeah, and then it's a nice flip of your sort of like Sparta Greek army narrative as well. When she theoretically comes from that same culture, but honestly, like, just Wonder Woman for everything. So Diana had to be my number one.
It's a great choice.
So now, Sarah, I want to ask, who is your number one?
All right. Well, number one for me is going to have to be America Chavez.
Nice.
From Young Avengers often, but also had her own amazing series, which was written by Gabby Rivera. If you want to hear more about Gabby Rivera, we interviewed her on Bitches on Comics. So there's an episode where we just talked to her about all of the things, you know, that we just like tripped out over when we were reading America. So America Chavez, of course, another character that was introduced as a straight character,
question mark, I guess.
You know, you know, basically she's like, I have a crush on a boy or something, but it's kind of inorganic. And then, whenever she comes back, like, I think they don't even bring it up for a huge portion of the Young Avengers, but at a certain point they're like, you, and she's like, yeah, gay, right, totally. and then of course, you know, there's her ongoing flirtation with Kate Bishop, which, you know, hearts everywhere. But, you know, Kate probably will never come out of the closet, unfortunately. So America gets to just be out, right? Like, that's great about her. She punches star-shaped holes in dimensions so that she can travel through them. She's 100% there for her friends. Also, queer character Loki tries to get one over on her often, and it just never works because she sees right through him. She has two moms, which is beautiful. And, like, actually, we talked a lot with Gabby about how, you know, there's a scene of the two moms having, like, giving birth to America. And that hasn't happened. There's no, it's like when we look at queer love stories and, you know, childbirth through, like, queer people, often it's, you know, an adoption story or something. And, you know, we almost always see it through, like, a heteronormative lens, mm-hmm. right? Which in some ways makes sense. But then it's like, hey, we're working in imagination world. So, like, why don't we have imagination world? What would queer childbirth look like if we just got to imagine what it would be like, right? And that's kind of what happens in the America series.
Truly no less insane than people who fly and have superpowers.
Oh, God. I mean, it, like, that's the point, right? Is like, and then also, I mean, we're not so far removed from it. Like, there's there's a, you know, huge possibility that at some point this is going to be something that is possible for queer couples. But, like, you know, we don't know. It's always like kind of, you know, I just think that it's a narrative that just hasn't been able to have room to breathe, really. So it's great to see that. And, you know, her moms don't usually play a very big part because they sacrifice their lives to save the universe and, you know, all of the things that, you know, made America who she is, kind of. But she's, you know, just the best character. It's like she has flaws. She fights with her girlfriend, you know, like she has all of these problems, but she's one of those characters that is so community oriented. And that's something that you see a lot in the America series, is her being like, I'm not the hero. Like, we're the hero. Like, there's a lot of heroes. We need everybody to bring their A game to be able to fix the problems that we're facing. And I think that that's a message that we need to see more in superhero comics and in, you know, any stories. We need to see that it's, you know, people power that's raising people up, not just one savior who's going to save us. And so all of those reasons, the fact that she's almost always been an out character, the fact that she is so powerful and so smart and so funny and, you know, gets to flirt and be, you know, have issues and all of those things, you know, I mean, that's why she has to be number one for me.
Nice. Also, I think soon destined to show up in the MCU.
Has to. Yeah. I mean, come on. Also, like, where it's like you read comics and it's like, where is America? Like, you guys, it's like you can't drop the ball on this character. This is one that has to stick around. Like, she has a huge fandom. She won people over so hard during, like, the Young Avengers. Mm-hmm. Like, people loved that character whenever she got her own series, you know, and it's written by a Latinx writer and, like, all of those things, you know, that just made, I think that made everybody so excited. And also, that's a comic that gets taught in class in, yep, like, colleges now, which is so great, you know, so, so great. So it's like, I mean, there's just only good vibes with that character, pretty much.
Nice. Alrighty, Jason, we've got two women in the number one slots. Who is your number one?
Well, we're going to make it a trifecta.
Nice. Ladies on top.
My number one queer comic book character, and this was kind of my easy choice for number one when thinking about this list, is Renee Montoya, as I like to call her, The Question.
Yeah,
my favorite.
Yeah. I prefer The Question Renee Montoya over Detective Renee Montoya. She earned that superhero moniker, and I'm going to give it to her.
No, she did.
Yeah. Now, if you don't know, Renee Montoya, of course, is a fictional DC comic character. Interesting enough, she was created for Batman the Animated Series first as a background character.
Harley Quinn.
Yep. In 1992, she was voiced by Ingrid Olu and Leanne Shermer. But she didn't really become a recurring character in the comic books until Batman 475, where she's promoted as a homicide detective by Commissioner James Gordon. She's partnered with Harvey Bullock eventually, and they become very close friends. But it's really changes for Renee Montoya basically in the No Man Land storyline and Gotham Central storylines.
Both now, highly recommended over the course of this podcast.
Yes, we love both of those storylines. It's in No Man's Land where it's first hinted that Renee Montoya is a lesbian. And this is sort of a storyline in that where Two-Face learns, because Two-Face develops a crush on her, and Two-Face learns that Renee Montoya obviously has no interest in him because she's a lesbian. And then during the Greg Rucka and Ed Ruhiger run of Gotham Central, which is one of the greatest DC comic series ever published about the Gotham Major Crimes Unit, where Renee is partnered with Crispus Allen, Two-Face outs her as a lesbian to the public and also frames her for murder. Now, during this amazing storyline, Montoya is cleared of all charges. Two-Face returns to Arkham, but Renee's personal life becomes chaotic because while her younger brother knew about her sexuality, her parents are from the Dominican Republic, Hernando and Lucia, and they are super religious, very Catholic, and they disown her immediately. And a lot of the rest of Gotham Central is about Renee trying to get public acceptance of her true self. And I think she sort of gets it back by claiming the question moniker, mm-hmm. which happens in another great series, 52. And through that and her becoming the question, it's sort of her becoming, again, her natural true self. And I think the fact that a sort of supporting character Batman comic introduces this powerful storyline is pretty compelling. Again, it's Gotham Central is essentially a Batman comic book. Of course, Renee later goes on to become the girlfriend of Batwoman, but I kind of always liked Renee on her own. And Renee actually just recently was in the Lois Lane miniseries as the question and was a pretty powerful, talk about a trifecta of very powerful women. Now, a lot of that series is Lois Lane, Renee Montoya, and I forget the other third character. I'm sorry, but a DC supporting, also super awesome badass lady. But this is about Renee Montoya, so it doesn't matter. I just think that the Gotham Central storyline is very powerful. And again, I love it when sexuality is not used for tokenism. It's used to improve and better a character. And I really think it does that for Renee Montoya. And that is why, for me, she was my number one queer comic book character.
Nice. What a great list we all came up with. I'm going to pat us on the back.
We didn't have a lot of crossovers, which surprised me.
We didn't. I truly was impressed. I expected a bunch of Lokis and a bunch of Harley Quinns.
Yes. All right. So let's move now into our recommended reading. Ashley, what is that?
The recommended reading is where if you go to geekhistorylesson.com/recommended reading, you click on the little widgets, you buy something from Amazon, and you steal money out of Jeff Bezos' pockets, and you give it to us because we're not as rich as him. And we are going to be making recommendations based on everybody's top three characters in their list today. I just want to let you know we're going to be including Wonder Woman Earth 1, the Renee Montoya Question series, and Volume 1 of the America Chavez series, among others. So go and check that out. Read yourself some cool comics.
Yes, and then tell us about the next section, Ashley.
The next section is the honor roll, where if you go to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review, we'll read whatever you write. If you are an international listener, please be sure to take a screenshot and email it to geekhistorylesson@gmail.com because we don't have access to your iTunes. Sorry.
The first person joining the honor roll this week is DTrain86. Who said, "Hello, Geek History Lesson. This podcast is by far one of my favorites. I get a huge smile when I see a new episode hit my playlist. I've listened to all of them and continue to look forward to more. Jason and Ashley are great hosts and keep the conversation light and funny. I love learning more about each comic book character, and it has taken my nerd level to greater heights. My favorite parts of the show are the discussion times and how publication history affects the characters. I like to imagine myself at a table answering the discussion questions. The Doctor Strange Christmas specials are also enjoyable and can't wait for this year's special. If you love comic books and other nerd things like this, this is a must-listen podcast. West Coast Avengers," and then he has music notes. The next person is Wayne Dark, who gave us 5 stars and said, "Recently found this podcast and have fallen in love. The two hosts are great and work together so well. and help in their own thoughts on the topic they're covering. They definitely know what they're talking about and have definitely taught me some interesting facts. Still hoping to see a Connor Kent Superboy episode in the future, but no matter the topic, I'm also going to be tuning in. Well, Wayne Dark, you might get your wish very, very soon. Thank you, DTrain86, and Wayne Dark, you are welcomed into the Geek History Lesson Teacher's Lounge. Ashley, what will they find inside there?
Well, in the Teacher's Lounge, I suspect that they will find Professor Montoya preparing for her next class.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I was going to say Professor Sarah Century because she did such a fantastic job on today's top five list that she's definitely going to be now faculty of the Mayan University. Miss Century, where can people follow you on social media, or where can they find some of your work, some of your writing? Because if they're not impressed by you like me, they should be, and they should definitely track you down online.
Thank you. So you can find me. I have a website, www.sarahcentury.com, perhaps obviously. And I don't have an H in my name, so that might help. I'm at Sarah Century on Twitter. I also have an Instagram, but it's like all pictures of my cats. So, I mean, you know, choose your own adventure. But also, I really regularly write for Sci-Fi Wire, the Fangirls branch of that. So tons and tons and tons of comic book and film criticism in there from me. And I'm the co-host and co-founder of Bitches on Comics podcast, which is a lot of fun. And we talk about lots and lots and lots of queer subject matter. We have a ton of interview people who we interview guests, I don't know, interviewees. We have that. And we also did a collection of fiction, which was called Decoded, which had 30 different stories by 30 different queer writers that were all just speculative fiction. So that's like sci-fi, fantasy, horror. And you can buy a subscription to that at decodedpride.com if you would like. The PDF is going up probably before the weekend's over. So by the time this is up, you can buy the PDF.
Nice. And we'll have links to all of that in the description of this podcast, so you can go check out Sarah. Everyone out there, don't forget to follow Ashley on Twitter and Instagram at Ashley V. Robinson.
Tweet
and follow
me cute pictures of Wiccan.
Yeah. And then also don't forget to follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Jawin, at Jawiin. And don't forget our next comic book, Jupiter Jet and the Forgotten Radio, being released by Action Lab, hits stores on October 7th. So go tell your local comic book shop about it. They have to pre-order it, or go find it on Amazon. It's there as well. Now we're to the last section of the podcast, hashtag stick around, where we see if you stuck through the plugs, because we're going to talk more. Sarah, I want to ask you, who were some of your also-rans? Who were some people that almost made it into your top five but kind of got bumped out?
Well, you actually brought up a few of them, but obviously one of the most glaring examples is going to be Batwoman, which I was kind of surprised none of us chose. But, you know, it's kind of an obvious one. I think that the Marguerite Bennett series that was about Batwoman is an underrated classic. So I highly recommend anybody check that out. And I love that character. I love what's happening with the new CW show. It looks like it's going to go in really good places on its second season. We were all a little bit hesitant when they were like, we're going to recast. And we're like, oh, no.
Yeah, yeah.
but then it was like, oh, yes. Like, that was exactly what we wanted. Awesome. Great. You know, like, no offense to Ruby Rose, who had great reasons for leaving the set, you know. But yeah, I would say Batwoman definitely. And I love the interactions between Renee and Batwoman. That's one of my ships for sure. Also, Mystique was one of my also-rans, so, you know, covered that. Thunder,
yes!
Who is on the Black Lightning series.
I love her.
It's because she's so good on the Black Lightning series, and we don't see enough of her in the comics, that she didn't make my list, but that is one of the best characters. I love her relationship with Grace. I think Grace is another character that is just incredible. Like, I love those two a lot. So they definitely are on there. Of course, you know, I would be remiss if I were going to neglect mentioning two of the most important queer characters in my personal development, which was Sailor Neptune and, you know, Sailor Uranus.
Heck yeah.
Both of whom, I mean, like, yeah, once again, it's the same as Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy, where you look back and you're just like, no, I knew what I was talking
Remember
about.
Remember when
I
the
thought
English
that they
language
were...
dub said they was cousins and none of
yes,
us believed
I
it?
I actually wrote a little bit about that because it was a very weird message to send. It's like, that's actually much more perverse.
Yeah.
like, oh yeah, you know, they're like gazing dreamily into one another's eyes and holding hands as cousins often do. very upsetting. I was going to say too, Vamprilla. Vamprilla is one of my very favorite characters of all time. Dynamite Comics just recently went on a wild one. And
doesn't
they
mean
kind
it's
of,
not a great character.
Yes, they tanked pretty much their entire line. And I'm not going to be too surprised if Dynamite has to, you know, close their doors. But Vamprilla was wonderful. And it was under that imprint that, like, they actually had her come out and have, like, a girlfriend. And she's been pansexual. Like, I've written articles about Vamprilla, another character who's just been around forever. And I don't think always gets her due. So I loved that character. But because of Dynamite shenanigans, I was like, I'm not going to bring that up.
I also... almost put the Ray on my list. People who have been listening since Crisis on Earth X know that I love the Ray, and I love him and his boyfriend, Citizen Cold. So he was the one that I was so sad to have to knock off. Jason?
Mm-hmm. The one that I'm surprised nobody put on here, and it's one that almost made it on my list, is Archie's Kevin Keller.
Iconic?
Oh, yes.
But yeah, for me, it's like I the reason why he got bumped off of my list is just because very recent addition.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, and I didn't feel a connection, as much of a connection to him as I did the other characters that I put on my list. So, but there you go. All right. These are, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. This was an excellent podcast episode, if I do say so myself, about our own episode.
Yeah, that's me. Every time I have an episode, I'm like, oh, yeah, that was great. I loved listening to the sound of my own voice. thanks for having me. This was incredible. I love talking about this stuff, and I love talking about all of your choices. Like, all of these choices were great.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for joining us. And thank you, everybody out there listening, for joining us for this episode of Geek History Lesson. I am Jason. I'm a big fan of the question. Renee Montoya Inman.
I am Ashley Victoria Robinson. And Professor Jason, would you please dismiss the class?
Class is now dismissed.